I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Welcome to The High-Low, the weekly current affairs and pop culture podcast brought to you by Dolly Alderton and Pandora Sykes. Hi, Dolly.
Hello.
Let's start with the debate. How long can we hold off tights for?
November the 1st.
So Dolly today is wearing espadrilles.
And a linen jacket.
And has bought the sun on a string.
I just can't bear to let go of the old flimsy flimsies yet.
I quite like bare legs in winter.
I do.
A thick sock, singular, and a heavy boot, singular.
I do. I actually think October dressing is my favourite. Like a roll neck with a mini skirt and bare legs.
Yeah, that's very you.
It's nice, isn't it?
Yeah,
it's nice. Like 1 month that you get it.
It's nice.
When are you going to pull the tights up?
I'm going to try and hold off till November, but it does mean you
maternity
have to keep legs
tights must be
moisturised,
yes,
and lightly tanned. Yeah, maternity tights are a trip. It's so comfy, though.
Are they?
Yeah.
Do they just have a very sort of...
Yeah. Dolly
billowing,
is miming
billowing.
A enormous stomach area.
Yeah.
Yeah, they just have a billowing stomach area. Yeah. And I actually held on to them when I wasn't pregnant as well, because then it's just like, it's such a treat to wear, wear pregnancy tights.
I love you.
Pregnant.
My ex-flatmate, Belle, one of my favourite images of living with her that I hold in my head and my heart forever is when I came home and she'd come back from a bad date early and she was eating like the most enormous Pyrex bowl of penne, like almost like a mixing bowl of penne on the sofa wearing her mum's maternity jeans from the 80s.
I didn't know they even made maternity jeans in the 80s.
Yeah,
think every woman should have a pair of maternity jeans for when she just needs a little bit of a hug.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. That's a good business idea, Panda.
In the news this week, Boris Johnson, rapidly clearing out the cabinet of anyone who isn't a hardcore Brexiteer, lost his own brother, Joe Johnson, from the cabinet after his wife said, "It's me or Boris." Former Zimbabwean dictator Robert Mugabe has died, age 95, and Juul faces a huge fine for illegally advertising their vaping devices as healthier than cigarettes. Your beloved friend, Dolly, Majuli.
I brought it with me today, actually.
What do you think about this?
I am a bit worried about Majuli, actually.
How have we never made that joke before?
I think we might have done.
No!
We haven't.
Absolutely not.
I am a bit worried about Majuli because I have been... this will sound very boastful. There's no way of saying this without sounding boastful. I've been running quite a lot the last 6 months, which is the same... That's when I started on the Juul. And when I have a heavy night vaping away with the old Glacier Mint, the next day, if I try to go for a run, my lungs feel heavier than if I'd smoked 20 fags. Like, it's really, really noticeable.
I'd really like a Fox's Glacier Mint right now.
Would you?
Yeah, as a flavour of gin.
There's mango, there's vanilla. Were you ever tempted? I know you can't now, but
no.
Would you? You weren't tempted by it?
No.
Do you know Juul's most rapidly increasing market are non-smokers?
Yeah, I know. Teenagers.
Yeah.
Teenagers. Yeah. It's.
I've got friends who haven't smoked ever, and now, like, I know a bloke in his mid-30s who started Juuling.
Emily Sheffield, the former deputy editor of Vogue, wrote a column, I think for The Standard, about 6 months ago, about how amongst her teenager and her teenager's friends, like, the biggest status symbol was, like, what Juul you had.
Mm.
And, like, every time a new flavour came out, they'd, like, flock to the newsagent.
Like Pogs?
I think Pogs were aimed more at, like, nine-year-olds. And Siri refuses to confirm that she's a feminist. Internal documents leaked by a Siri grader, who was employed to check Apple's voice assistant for accuracy, revealed that Siri should deflect questions about feminism by merely saying she believes in equality.
Don't know how I feel about that.
This is an improvement on her previous repertoire, where she was downright dismissive on the subject, using responses like, I just don't get this whole gender thing. She sounds like a sort of 90-year-old man. Or when someone called her a slut, she would say, I'd blush if I could. Now she says, I won't respond to that.
Why have they made her this fusty old Tory in an Alice band?
Well, as someone pointed out, a lot of these AI devices are designed by men, so it...
Right.
The sort of slut line was probably quite comical, and maybe now the whole feminist one is also flummoxing them. This story's just
all
so fast
these flummoxed men sitting in Silicon Valley.
I feel like we're talking about a Furby, except that it has huge data and cultural ramifications. We have to remember that some kids are learning and speaking a lot to their voice assistant, like Alexa or Siri or Google.
If kids are learning about language and life from their voice assistant, I mean, do you really think that that's, like, happening?
Yeah, I think kids are learning about anything that they're subjected to. Like Peppa Pig. I think that's probably where they get a lot of their...
Apparently Peppa Pig is not very woke. Have you watched it?
I think they're all... I think it's a fairly traditional dynamic.
Yeah. It's interesting that that hasn't been more picked up on.
Maybe there's moves. I haven't read a lot about pigs.
Or maybe all these very, like, right-on progressive parents are just so knackered and zoned out when they've got Peppa Pig on that they don't even notice.
Did you see the news article this week, which I have to say just made me roll my eyes about? There's a really lovely children's book called 5 Minutes Peace.
With the elephant
and her three young elephants. You might recognise it. She tries to have a cup of tea, but they all come and get into the bath with her.
Right.
Anyway, she eats a piece of cake at one point, and I don't know, apparently she's like permanently on a diet, and lots of, like, the woke mums have talked about the fat-shaming elephant.
I do see that point, actually.
The retort to that is they are elephants.
That's true. Do you know what? I can see both sides of that, because I do remember picking up the word diet when I was about 5 years old, and that did not end well for me. You know, I do think that, like, kids are sensitive to that language. And you want to be, like, a grown-up lady or a grown-up lady elephant. Do you see that, or do you think it's all just hysterical?
I think it's
hysterical?
I think she's an elephant. Yeah. I mean, go purge Sadie's bookshelves, if you'd like. It woke up her bookshelves for me.
I can be Thatcher Wine for Sadie's bookshelves.
The woke Thatcher Wine. More on him later. Also in the news this week, the world's oldest mother has had twins, aged 74.
My God.
Amata Mangayama, who has been married to her husband for 57 years, gave birth to twin girls after IVF treatment in Guntur, India. I feel quite conflicted about that. 74. Wonder how much of her kids' life she'll be around for.
It's been a rough old week for Ringo Starr. Have you seen this story?
I have not, but I think CJ has, because he just did one of those little nose puffs.
The snuffly laughs that I like.
Yeah.
So Ringo Starr gave an interview in 2017 in which he said he would have voted for Brexit had he been living in the UK. He actually wasn't saying that initially. He was saying that he believed that it's important that we move forward with the deal after the referendum result, which a lot of people agree with. Some of the staunchest Remainers I know feel that the kind of lack of action with Brexit post-referendum is a real threat to democracy and the kind of validity of our electoral system. So that itself is not a controversial stance. Then the interviewer pushed him for what he would have done if he'd been living here.
Would you have voted that way?
I would have voted for Brexit, yes. I would have voted to get out. But don't tell Bob Geldof.
Why did you vote that way, Ringo?
Well, because I think it's a great move. I think, you know, to be in control of your own country is a good move.
Anyway, so this was back in 2017, and yesterday a Brexit-supporting tweeter posted the interview, calling Ringo a true patriot. The tweet and the interview was initially shared by pro-Brexit accounts and kind of right-wing accounts in America and here. And despite it being widely reported that this was from 2017, Remain supporters also responded to the video as though it were now, with many expressing their disappointment in Ringo Starr. Theresa Griffin, the Labour MEP for the North West of England, said, "I live in the Welsh streets, Liverpool, where Ringo was born. He doesn't live here, doesn't pay taxes here, and has no idea of the devastation Brexit is already causing. If you want to smirk about Brexit, come back home, visit local workplaces and listen." The comedian Shappy Corsandi tweeted, "Cut me in half and you'll see the word remain running through me, but I am not the same animal as the people tearing down Ringo Starr's talent for having a different view. Unless you've been in the Beatles or voiced an iconic cartoon yourself, let him be." And my personal favourite came from Matt Haig. He tweeted, "Ringo Starr wants Britain to leave Europe, but he also wants to be under the sea in an octopus's garden in the shade, which is also a very bad decision."
I'm definitely of Shappy Corsandi's.
Yeah, me too.
I'm in her camp. I find this sort of binary polarisation to be really valueless, and I'm getting really bored of the histrionics where we take one person and sort of project everything onto them.
I agree. I think it's a totally disproportionate reaction, and it wasn't even a story because it was from 2 years ago. And I think what leaving the EU would look like and what the knock-on effect would be for Britain was a totally different thing for most people at that point. So firstly, it's just completely out of context, but I just think really what this reaction exemplifies is just what a continuously unresolved disaster we're in, and just how angry a lot of Remain voters feel towards Leave voters. And I do get that. I feel the same. I have one person in my life who voted Leave, and for a long time I found it very hard not to tell him how much, you know, he's helped fuck up our country and waste government time and money with what I believe was a totally misinformed vote. But I also think that while Ringo's views are not the views most circulated on Twitter or voiced among celebrities or the views that you hear in the pub in London, they are the views of that voting majority. So to act with kind of shock and disgust and to dismiss him or launch a hate campaign against him is to miss the point, I think. And increasingly, my instinct when I meet someone politically opposed to me is to ask why they vote that way, rather than see it as an opportunity to sort of scold them or lecture them.
I mean, I don't think anyone should be telling anyone off. I just don't think that that's solving anything. But increasingly, that does seem to be the slightly farcical way in which we're discussing politics and political views.
Mm. I also wanted to bring this up to check whether you know about what I would say is probably my favourite video on the internet.
That's high praise. You like a lot of videos.
I think I watch it 3 times a week and think about it 5 times a day.
I don't know. What is this video?
So it's Ringo Starr went through this phase where he did a lot of videos of himself alone at home in this like massive house in California. And they had like a sort of hostage vibe. There was no sort of sense of space or time.
What decade was this?
I'd say about 5 years ago.
Oh, okay, quite recent.
And he, maybe a bit longer ago actually. They're always quite grainy quality. And my favourite one that he did is him talking to the camera about how he no longer wants to receive any more fan mail after October the 20th. And he's obviously, something has just tipped him over the edge and he's just completely had enough. And I think I love it so much because it just reminds me of that mode that I go into that you know very well, where I just feel like I've had too many WhatsApp messages or that my inbox is just, I've had too many emails and just enough is enough.
This is a serious message to everybody watching my update right now. Peace and love, peace and love. I want to tell you, please, after the 20th of October, do not send fan mail to any address that you have. Nothing will be signed after the 20th of October. If that has a date on the envelope, it's going to be tossed. I'm warning you with peace and love, but I have too much to do. So no more fan mail. Thank you, thank you. And no objects to be signed. Nothing. Anyway, peace and love, peace and love.
I regularly will just send into your voice note saying it's going to be tossed.
I can't believe you've never shown me that. In fellow comic news, I want to introduce you to the HMV thread of tweets. I meant to mention this last week. It made me laugh so much. They're from a freelance comedy writer named only on Twitter as Laura, no surname, with the handle @fairycakes, who is reflecting on her surreal employment at HMV 11 years ago. The Hilo sub-editor Anna wonders if they are in fact fictitious comedy material, but
I don't mind it when I see those anecdotal Twitter threads that are funny. I don't really mind if they're real.
I think either way they're very funny. I'm gonna read it out to you. One day a bloke came in wearing a pair of sunglasses claiming he was Paul Weller. He asked if he could have a selection of CDs by The Jam for free, as he'd misplaced his copies. Another guy came in every week to buy all the new singles in the UK Top 40. He was about 85 and had been a travelling DJ since the 60s. He hadn't had any work in years, but he wanted to purchase all the latest chart hits just in case. I can imagine you did.
Very much so.
I haven't written a book in 35 years, but I just want to make sure I've got all the booker. One bloke got banned because he kept covering his hands in blue paint and touching the CDs to try and get them for a reduced price as they were damaged. A man tried to get a refund on a Tom and Jerry box set because the storylines were repetitive. One regular customer who looks exactly... this is my favourite. Who looks exactly like the Queen bought the Priest's album four times. On her fourth purchase, I asked her why she was getting so many copies. How do you remember me buying them? Is it because I look like the Queen? Because I get very, very angry when people say that. And she did. One day, another customer told her she looked like the Queen and she hit him with her handbag. One woman knocked down a shelving unit of Cheryl Cole books and calendars because she said she had the face of a bitch. A man threatened legal action when he discovered that instead of a staff member ordering him in Candyman, the horror film, they ordered in a CD single of Candyman by Christina Aguilera. A woman came in three times asking me to check the central ordering database to see if she could buy the book that the film Mamma Mia was based on. Channel 5 News came in to film some vox pops about the X Factor, but eventually gave up after everyone they spoke to in the store just ended up calling Simon Cowell a wanker.
That's so funny. I almost think that you want to print that and bind it and give it as a manual to anyone wanting to understand, like, the British disposition.
What's your favourite?
I like the Queen one.
I like the man with the blue paint on his hands damaging CDs because it's just such a unsubtle mode of operation.
I also love the one about Tom and Jerry narratives being too repetitive, because I think that sums up this, like, very British disposition of just wanting to be angry and complain about completely futile things. That's brilliant. I love that. I also obviously wanted to talk about the emotional support horse on a plane. Did either of you read about this?
Nope.
Buckle up. Last week, a passenger brought a miniature horse called Flirty on board an American Airlines flight from Chicago to Nebraska.
I love the name Flirty for a horse.
Forget horse, what about for a child?
For a boy.
Flirty the boy. Little Flirty. The docile pony was captured on video by several passengers standing in the footwell. In early clips, the miniature horse is also seen trotting through the airport. An American Airlines spokesperson told The Independent, the miniature horse was a trained service animal.
And what type of horse was it? Was it a Falabella then?
I don't know, Pandora.
Because you keep referring to its size, which makes me think it must be a...
It was very little. I've looked at the pictures of it.
Okay.
I would say, like...
Because that's different to bringing a stallion.
Yeah, no, it wasn't a stallion. I would say it was probably smaller than a Shetland, actually. Quite a weirdly small horse.
So they could have probably argued it was a dog.
Yeah, it would be the size as, like, maybe a Rhodesian Ridgeback, I would say.
Okay, cool.
An American Airlines spokesperson told The Independent, this miniature horse was a trained service animal, which American Airlines accepts on board following evaluation on a case-by-case basis. We recognise the important role trained service dogs, cats and miniature horses can play in lives of those with disabilities, and they are welcome in the cabin at no charge if they meet the requirements. In the past, passengers have tried to board flights with animals such as squirrels, peacocks and a turkey.
I feel like I recognise the idea of a emotional support peacock. Did someone try and bring their peacock on a plane? Did you...
I can't
deliver
remember.
...deliver news of that last year?
Do you remember before jabs or exams at school and there would always be one girl with a kind of, like, suitcase of Beanie Baby toys?
Why would you have a suitcase of Beanie Baby?
As, like, a comfort, as, like, a good luck charm.
No, I don't.
Really? Did you not have that?
No.
And everyone would have a Beanie Baby on their desk.
No, I mean,
while they
I
were doing
not.
Their
I still have
sats.
My, still have my collection of Beanie Babies. And my last story to bring to you today is the woman who set up a GoFundMe page after her Tinder date called her fat. 28-year-old Jade Savage opened a fundraiser to raise back the £93 she spent on a date where she travelled from Leicester to Peterborough only to be told by her date that she put on weight.
That is horrific, obviously, but do we know if this was a first date?
Yes, it was a first date.
Leicester to Peterborough, it's quite a journey for a first date.
You do realise the story is about her setting up a GoFundMe page for people to pay for her date, where he said this. I mean, clearly he's a douche, but I don't think this should be the kind of thing that GoFundMe is used for.
But why did she go so far for a first date?
The idea that people should pay you back for a shitty experience, I think that's just part of life.
Yeah.
Yeah, I agree. I think it's far for a date, but people will travel for love. But I mean, do you think that she should be paid back by members of the public for that date?
I mean, I think it's entrepreneurial of her.
Do you want to know how much she's raised?
How much?
£400. So she's profited.
Well, I mean, it sounds pretty horrible what she had to go through. So if she's pocketing some,
it's not worth a fundraiser.
Fine, maybe not a fundraiser page. I think maybe I feel quite an affinity with this woman. I'm glad that she's made some money out of it.
I mean, clearly he's an absolute toe rag, but I do slightly despair. What's new in the mailbag this week, doll?
Since last week's episode aired, reports have come out that the Bristol teenager who went blind after eating a poor diet has a rare condition called avoidant restrictive food intake disorder, known as ARFID. It's an eating disorder in which sufferers will eat only a very limited range of foods and may have significant phobias and is thought to be connected to autism. A number of you wrote in about this, so we thought it was worth clarifying, as it was obviously an important missing piece of information in the story as it was reported last week.
I haven't heard of that disorder before, so thanks for updating us on that.
And we received some emails about the etymological beginnings of the phrase and hashtag hot girl summer that we mentioned last week, which has its roots in black culture rather than a way for Miley Cyrus to make digs at her girlfriend's ex. A listener wrote in with this observation. I feel like this is reflective of the countless times when black women's contribution within society is undermined and overlooked by others. I understand that the hashtag may have been more accessible to some following Miley Cyrus's comment on a Brody Jenner post. However, I feel to say this propelled the hashtag into the mainstream is undermining both Megan Thee Stallion and the thousands of largely, but not exclusively, black women who have been sharing and celebrating the hot girl summer long before Miley flaunted it on Instagram to her followers.
I must admit, I didn't deep dive into the hashtag. It is sort of impossible to do that with every internet trend. But this shows, as is often the case with most hashtags, I mean, I always remember Me Too, which was a movement started by Tarana Burke in 2005, rather than one started by, you know, Hollywood actresses 2 years ago, is that hashtags, where they end up or where they end up being most visible, is rarely where they start, even a seemingly daft-sounding hashtag like hot girl summer. So thank you for the background. In response to our discussion of book acknowledgements, this is so great, a listener sent in the brilliant acknowledgements page at the end of Marianne Power's book Help Me. Mum just called me. Please don't write 5 pages of thank yous. I'm fed up of all these gushing acknowledgements at the end of books. Anyone would think they'd prevented war the way they go on, instead of writing something that nobody's going to read. I decided to skip over the implication that nobody was going to read this book. So you don't want me to thank you then, I ask. No, because then you'd have to thank your sisters and your friends and your aunts and your uncles. And where does it end? Before you know it, you're thanking the dog. We don't have a dog, I say. You know what I mean, Marianne. So what should I say? Just say thank you to your friends and family and leave it at that. No names. OK, so thank you to my friends and family. No names, but I hope you know who you are.
I love that. What a great acknowledgements page. And finally, we were so happy to hear from Rachel Wilson, who some listeners may remember as the woman who wrote in a while back to share her feelings of loneliness when she was in the depths of grief. We were inundated with personal messages of support from people who also had experienced loss, which led to meetups. Now Rachel has launched an official support network, the Grief Network, for bereaved young people. Rachel told us, having run the meetups for a year or so now, I'm launching a series of events that will challenge what grief looks like as a young person, and the launch will be a panel talk on the 2nd of October in Shoreditch. I'm super excited. We've got Carrie Ad Lloyd, Felix White from the Maccabees and Tailenders, and Teresa Lola, the Young Person's Laureate, on the panel, which will be hosted by me. Teresa will give a reading of her poetry as well. The event is called Hashtag Still Grieving. Go to www.thegrief.network. And you can find them on Instagram at Grief Network for more information. Tickets go on sale next week. And both Pandora and I were both just so happy to hear of how this has progressed, and massive congratulations to Rachel for all the work that she's done and how far it's come.
I think this might be the best thing that's come out of the high-low, and quite a few of my friends have actually emailed me about it and then gone on to get in touch with Rachel, so it has already proved itself as a really valuable resource. Yeah. And it's really exciting to watch it grow from sad origins into something hopeful, I think, with what she's building.
Pandora, what are your cultural recommendations for us this week?
I am currently reading Testaments by Margaret Atwood.
Oh, what's it like?
She's had the biggest hype of a book since Harry Potter and the Goblet of Fire. Do you remember when the Harry Potter books came out? And were like massive, the excitement. And I would go and buy it on that day as well.
Dressed up as a witch.
And in The Devil Wears Prada, one of the hardest challenges for Anne Hathaway is to get two proof copies of Harry Potter for her twins to read on the train. And she manages to do it. And there was this massive midnight event last night at Waterstones. People lucky enough to get a proof only got one. I think mine arrived on like Friday. You know how normally you can get book proofs like 4 months in advance? Right on Friday, and Lorraine Candy, who interviewed Margaret Atwood for the Sunday Times Style, said that before she interviewed Margaret, she read the book, but she was basically locked in a room for 5 hours without her phone, and a Penguin PR was guarding outside the room. So it's so clandestine. It's good. I think it does a lot of backstory. I'm literally too scared to say anything, even though it did come out today, day of record, because I'm not really sure of the protocol around this. I mean, it's on the Booker shortlist of 6 books, even though like one person had read it or something. But yeah, it answers lots of questions that I think people have, gives a lot of backstory. It is quite different. Yeah, it's good. I'm enjoying it.
Is it a follow-on of The Handmaid's Tale?
It's sort of both. It's both a follow-on, and then it
stands alone.
And then it gives information on the status quo in The Handmaid's Tale, so it goes back and forth.
Right.
Which is what The Handmaid's Tale does. You know, at the end, there's that sort of hilarious postscript to if anyone finds this document from Gilead, and then there's like these Cambridge professors talking about it in 2195, I think, about whether or not, you know, this pompous Cambridge professor is talking about whether or not Gilead really existed or something like that.
Right.
So like that, you sort of go back and forward with time. I think it will do phenomenally well. If it's not number one on the Sunday Times bestseller list, I will eat your espadrille.
Please don't.
With a knife and fork. And Thatcher Wine has at last given an interview.
At last?
I mean, honestly, toss aside the testaments, because Thatcher Wine has given an interview to New York Magazine's website, The Cut. They talked to him last week, still obsessed with his name. About once a week I tweet about how I am still obsessed with his name. He is a book curator. If anyone hasn't been listening to Lina, he's a book curator who has sourced books for Jessica Chastain, Shonda Rhimes and Gwyneth Paltrow, which is how he went viral, because he sourced 600 books for her bookshelves, not to be read, but to be, you know, for decorative purposes. And people like me felt quite sad about this news. He has a book out called For the Love of Books, Designing and Curating a Home Library. And as the interviewer Hilary Reid points out, it's not called For the Love of Reading, but For the Love of Designing and Curating a Home Library. Her tone is very funny as an interviewer. It's perhaps a little cruel at times, gently mocking. At one point she says that Juniper Books, which is the company that Thatcher Wine set up in 2001, sells the classics in expensive hardcover editions dressed in decorative paper jackets that range from handsome to twee, the kind of gift that appeals to people who feel edgy carrying a tote emblazoned with a John Waters quote, "If you go home with somebody and they don't have books, don't fuck them."
I think I'm sort of with her, I have to say.
Do you want a tote bag that says if you go home with somebody and they don't have...
I mean, I have been guilty of Instagramming that John Waters quote before.
Have you?
Yeah, definitely. I'm just one big old fucking cliche.
He says some, like, mental stuff, though. Here are some snippets for you. I think what people realised with the rise of ebooks was that, hey, any printed books that are in the world are a good thing, whether you're reading them or not. If there's a potential to read them and there's a sort of gravitas of having them through osmosis that seeps into your identity.
I just think that's such bollocks, and that does make me quite angry.
I don't think books seep into your identity. And then here's another one. In the introduction for The Love of Books, which includes many lines from a TED talk that Thatcher Wine delivered in 2016, battered copy of The Catcher in the Rye in hand, he assures readers that something almost alchemical happens when we add books to our homes. By doing so, we combine the author and their story with who we are and our story.
Yeah, only if you fucking read it.
I also fundamentally disagree with that. Not that people shouldn't buy books, even one they don't read. Like, buy books that you haven't read or that you don't know when you'll have time to read. But that we combine our story with an author's. No, you don't. That's the author's story. Just all these books are not, like, seeping into me by osmosis and making me a part of their story. I'm not suddenly it's a little life because I've read it.
100%.
What book do you think you're in now that you've read it?
I don't know,
that it seeps into your identity like osmosis.
Do you know why I think it pisses me off?
No, I'm sorry, it doesn't.
I think that, you know, reading the novel is under threat as an activity. Like, that is, it poses...
Is it like reading the, reading is up more than ever? More books are sold.
Recently, but like more generally, when you look at the birth of online culture and the decline and the increase of busyness in life and the decline in reading.
The increase in perceived busyness.
Like, I went to a talk by Philip Hensher, who's a brilliant novelist, and he said this thing that is so scary, but I think is true. He said when he was younger, reading literature was as commonplace a recreational activity as watching TV or listening to the radio. And now the fear that he has is that reading a book will become as sort of niche an activity as like bell ringing or like, you know, collecting model railways. And our brains are changing in terms of the effect that modern life has on our concentration and our ability to be absorbed by a book. So I think that it's like the one activity and area in life where it's this like sacred place of, you know, removing one's ego from the activity. It's private. It's you're absorbed by a world. It's a relationship that you have to that story and to that writer. And to make it suddenly an aesthetic and boastful activity that is as a part of displaying your identity publicly is like what fucking Chanel lipstick you wear. I just think it's really grim.
But to do some myth debunking, that's a complete fallacy that our concentration span is changing and we can't read books. Your concentration span is as long as you want to concentrate on something. Mm. I wrote about this, and I think it was for Elle magazine, so I had to speak to a few... I think I spoke to a neuroscientist for it. And basically, the reason why we think we don't have a concentration span anymore is because we try and do so many things at once. Mm. So we cook whilst listening to a podcast, whilst also reading something. Or we watch something on telly whilst listening to a podcast, while also reading something. Or we drive whilst listening to a podcast and having a conversation with a friend. So it's not that your concentration span is less, it's that you're trying to splice up your concentration into too many bits. And actually, concentration span cannot be rewired.
Altered.
So it can't be altered. It is as long as you are engaged in an activity. Mm. The difficulty is we don't make space to engage in that particular activity by shutting off those other distractions. But as I said, I think reading is going up. What I would say is that the reading of novels is perhaps under threat because assholes like me and you are writing non-fiction books that we try and encourage people
to read. Do you know what? I saw a tweet about me this week which was really snarky, which said... basically said that I review too many books, that I put my name on the front of too many book covers.
Really?
Yeah, it really annoyed me, actually.
Did they at you in that?
No, they didn't. Someone told me about it, which was helpful.
Yeah, it is always helpful.
And I just feel like I will never, ever apologise. Because I had such a long period of my life where reading wasn't a part of my day-to-day life, and it is now, and I'm much happier for it, and I will never, ever apologise for being someone who champions that as an activity. Can you imagine having a dickish thing to say about someone endorsing other writers?
Also, that's hilarious. Someone's obviously just, like, been combing Waterstones for irrational things to annoy them. This idea that you just have these piles of books, like, one on trains, excellent, I'll endorse that, one on an aquarium, like... as opposed to a couple of books that you really love. I mean, fuck off.
I know.
It's like when people get annoyed that we don't talk about books we don't like. you know, I have to say, I find it really boring when I go onto Instagram or Twitter and I see someone being a dick about a book that a writer's written. If you didn't like it, that's fine. I don't think that we need to publicise everything we don't like. I think that's a massive problem with social media. I am sure when my book comes out, people will at me about how they haven't liked it, and I will light a flame under their butthole. I don't need to know.
You and me both, babe. I'll be your...
Will you be lighting buttholes?
Do you know what I heard about the other day that I think is a really good tactic for both of us when we have people tweeting or atting us, telling us that they don't like our book? I cannot remember who the author is, and I'm sure someone will tweet or email us to let us know. There was an author who did this thing online where every time someone would send her a link to a blog post where they were really trashing her book, or a horrible Goodreads review, or just a tweet or an Instagram post where they just expressed how much they didn't like her writing or her book, she would reply and say, I want you, because you've sent this to me today, I accept what you have said, but it's really important that you now go and tweet a writer whose book you loved.
Oh, that's a lovely thing.
And I think that's a really just like classy, gracious way of dealing with that kind of trash talking online.
Do you think that some...
To sort of readdress an equilibrium of how we speak to each other and review each
other. I think that's
work.
A really lovely idea. I wonder if she'll get some of those Amazon bars who will reply saying, well, all I was looking for was Tupperware. I can't tweet a book I like. I don't like books. I hope she finds some very interesting
people. Anyway, Thatcher Wine is not going to be on our dream dinner party.
So that's Thatcher Wine. No, I'm riveted by him. I don't have a... I've got no... truck with him.
Do you not mind that people buying books for decorative use?
No, I think it's silly, but I think him suggesting that I take on an author's story by having it on my shelf is sillier, but I do delight in it, and I will absolutely be writing more about this somewhere.
Thatcher Wine could end up being maybe the subject of your next book.
He's in this current one.
Is he?
Lastly, real gear change here. I read an interview with Anthony Ekindayo-Lennon with The Guardian's Simon Hattonstone with great interest. Do you remember we talked about this last year. In November last year, Anthony, who's a theatre director, was accused of passing as black in order to receive funding from black
yes.
and minority ethnic schemes.
Yes,
and this
I
came
remember.
In the wake of a lot of people talking about, I think, the Rachel Dolezal documentary came out, was it last
yeah.
year or the year before?
It was last year.
The response was pretty overwhelming, and The Sun suggested that Lennon identified as a black actor because he wouldn't get enough work as a white one. You know, there was a lot of media pile in and a lot of people being very upset, and he was also very overwhelmed by this. The interview is incredibly interesting and thoughtful and illuminating because it goes... Simon Hattonstone is a brilliant interviewer, and it goes back over his life and fleshes out a story that is very, very different, I think, to what, you know, those headlines on The Sun would
yeah.
say. It's true that Lennon is not black. His parents and his grandparents are white. But as Simon Hattonstone writes, rather than trying to pass as black, Lennon has spent a lifetime failing to pass as white, from babyhood to the present day. And many years ago, he decided to embrace that, to live with the identity that the rest of the world persisted in giving him. And in pictures both past and present, writes Hattonstone, he presents as black and mixed race. The one thing he doesn't appear to be, the writer says, is white. And after years of being told that, Lennon forged a identity for himself. Of course, race isn't just about what you look like, but Lennon says this is something he's been contending with his whole life, and it wasn't a secret from those that knew him. When the story broke, 48 black actors and activists came out in support of him and said they had known his story all along and supported who he was, including Michaela Coel and Lenny James. So, you know, some really prolific people came forward and said that they really believed in what he thought was his story. Most interestingly, and this really does challenge the idea that he was trying to hoodwink anyone, in 1990, Lennon appeared in a TV play called Chilling Out as part of the BBC's Everyman slot. And Simon Hattonstone's watch, I haven't watched it, but Simon Hattonstone watches it, and he says it's riveting. It's a really nuanced exploration of race and class and identity in which seven young actors, including Lenny James, talk about the experience and spirit of being black in Britain. The actors play themselves, but the scenes begin with improvisation and the end result is a scripted docudrama. When Lennon is asked about his backstory, he says he's from Ireland. The other actors nod approvingly and ask, which island? No, he says, Ireland, Ireland, and goes on to explain that both his parents are white. They look at him astonished, suggest he is in denial about his blackness. There are jokes about his mother and the milkman. And at the end of the interview, Lennon gets his DNA results back. So he'd called Simon Hattonstone and asked for an interview, kind of out of the blue, and said that he had something to tell him. So at the end of the interview, he shares what he had to tell with him. And it's his results that reveal he is 32% West African. Now, wow. Data results are not infallible, but Simon Hattonstone says to Anthony Akindale Lennon, do you feel vindicated by this? And he says, no, you know, the tests just confirm what he has already known, and that one day he will trace those roots. Now, I'm sure there are people that will you know, disagree with what he said in the interview, or take umbrage, or perhaps find it offensive, or not believe in it. You know, it's an incredibly divisive topic. I just thought it was a really interesting interview. Mm. I think very often when there are headlines, you just don't get the, obviously it's a headline, but you don't get the full story. And
but this story is a real reminder of that.
Yeah, and it's incredibly interesting, the backstory. And Simon Hattonstone is a really good interviewer as well, so I think it was definitely in the right hands. What have you been enjoying, Dol?
I have, rather unusually, two vicar-themed podcast recommendations this week.
Absolutely.
Of two entirely different podcasts. The first is the Reverend Donna Scopper, who was a guest on Alec Baldwin's podcast, Here's the Thing. Donna is a senior minister at Judson Memorial Church in New York City, which I've never heard of since this podcast episode. And actually, I know I've talked a lot about how much I love Alec Baldwin's podcast, but it is, he's really, really great in the same way that Desert Island Discs is so brilliant. And Fresh Air, it can be brilliant for this. He's really great at bringing on people of interest who you otherwise maybe wouldn't have found, who aren't celebs. So
I think that's important.
Yeah.
I think that's a reminder for the high-low. We've got to stop booking just that A-list, wall-to-wall A-list talent.
But yeah, that's he's really good. I think he always has a really good variety of bookings. There's one that he did recently that's about a man who's the expert on the gentrification and the architectural history of Tribeca, which is obviously incredibly specific. But I think it's really good to have those kind of in-depth interviews alongside interviews with kind of big Hollywood names, and to be interviewed with the same amount of kind of detail and interest and
enthusiasm.
So the Judson Church, from what she describes on the podcast, sounds like a very kind of progressive Christian community based in Greenwich Village. It offers services for the LGBTQ plus community, for sex workers, and for addicts, to name a few. It holds meetings on women's reproductive rights. Basically, it's trying to intersect rapid social change with Christian values and Christian worship, which is sadly something that's often in opposition.
No thanks to people like Jacob Rees-Mogg.
Exactly. And I really, really love listening to Donna speak. She's an author and a kind of theological scholar, and very funny as well, and very down to earth. And she's a practicing minister. And she talks on the show about how sad she is that Christianity has become so associated with the right and with conservatism and with Trump's America. And I have to say, I've always been incredibly unimpressed by how quickly modern atheists often are, or just like our modern sensibilities are, to hold up Christianity as being the sort of opposite to intellectualism and, you know, think thoughtfulness. And I generally find most modern takes on Christianity to be often quite short-sighted and patronising. And I say this as someone who is 100% not a Christian.
And I am a Christian, and I think that
as
well.
Yeah, and I just think Donna's interview reminds us of a different type of Christian, and it is a Christian that I know exists, and I think exists in abundance, who is someone who rejects the intolerance that's found in ancient biblical scripture and instead embraces those very Christ-like attitudes of inclusivity, kindness, anti-judgment, generosity and sensitivity. It was just a really refreshing listen.
So the mask for sex workers, are they people that what they're seeking is privacy? They want to be able to have confidentiality when they...
They wanted probably more space to organize than mm-hmm. to pray. Mm-hmm. But we had Stormy Daniels people in a while back, which was really fun. She didn't come, but she sent things. We had Pleasure Sunday a while back. You know, we're trying to be on the edge and not be conceited about it. Mm-hmm. It wants to find the people who are outside of religion and have them tell us who God is.
I also adored Three Vicars Talking, which is a Radio 4 series in which Reverend Richard Coles, celebrity Reverend Richard Coles, Kate Botley, who you might remember as the priest from Gogglebox, and Giles Fraser talk about, and weirdly Donna talks about this phrase as well in her episode, hatching, matching and dispatching.
I can see exactly how that works. I love that.
Which is christenings, weddings and funerals. So there are three episodes of Three Vicars Talking about those three different subjects. The wedding episode is full of very funny, sort of quite hoary stories of groom no-shows and saying the wrong names in the vows and someone standing up when they say, does anyone have know of any lawful impediment? So that's a kind of fun episode. But it's the death one that I absolutely adored and implore everyone to listen to.
That's nice.
It's really uplifting. It's like, I know that sounds kind of...
No, it doesn't. I don't think there's any reason why sending someone off can't be uplifting or have elements of joy.
Yeah, and actually what you realise when you listen to this is like, fuck me, this is such an important part of life. This is something that's coming for all of us. This is something that most people have to deal with year on year in some way. And you just don't hear people discussing it. It's just not talked about. And it's very funny. As I say, it's quite reassuring and uplifting. It's about the role of the vicar in dying, death, funerals and mourning. It's full of dark humour. There's a brilliant story about... on a deathbed, one of the vicars has to do the sort of anointment, I don't know what the ritual is, with holy oil, and they didn't have holy oil to hand. And it was an urgent situation. The person was really nearing death quite rapidly, so they had to use Clinique face oil. Kate Botley is very funny, talking about her relationship with her undertaker, who she's always had a big crush on. But it's also very moving, and they all say that doing funerals, which might sound mad, but you understand by the end of it, is the favourite part of their job. Yeah. And is commonly a kind of seen as a real privilege and almost perk of this line of work, because they feel like they can actually offer something from their faith and their training and their beliefs that might be of some use to the people that are grieving. And it's just really warm and candid, and it's just a very, very unusual job and a very privileged position in life and a community that you very rarely hear talked about.
One of the hardest things I think about being a parish priest is when the ones you really love die. You've got someone in the parish who's really on your side, who's one of your team. And my friend Jean was coming to the end of her life, and I went to visit her. And she was one of those women that was always really worried about how you were. So she would always ask me every service, and how are you and how are the kids? You always left looking after everybody else. Who's looking after you? One of those kind of women. And I went to visit her and she said, I'm really worried about my funeral. I said, why is that? And she went, well, will you be able to do it? And I said, well, look, I'm a professional. It's what we do. So I'll do the visit, I'll be professional. I'll do your funeral, I'll be professional. I'll do the burial, I'll be professional. I'll do the wake, I'll be professional. But then when I get home, that'll be my time. And I'll get home and I'll put my pajamas on and I'll hug my kids and I'll go in the fridge and have a bottle of champagne in there and I'll open that and I'll drink it straight down. And that's when I'll say goodbye to you. And she laughed. Anyway, she died, and I did the funeral. I did everything I said. I did a really good job. I was really proud of myself, and I held it and held it and held it. And those tears were prickling the back of my eyes and the lump in my throat. And I got home, and I could feel myself walking up the drive, and I just had to get to that door before I could let it go. Mm. And as I got to the door of the house, of the vicarage, there was a bottle of champagne.
Oh, lovely.
And a little note from her that said, today's the day of my funeral. Drink this and enjoy it.
Nice.
I'm going to cry at that.
And that's the privilege, isn't it?
I don't often talk about music on the show because it makes me sound like your friend's very uncool dad standing by his Volkswagen making small talk. But I've just started listening to a band that I think our listeners would really, really love if they don't already know and love them. They're called Moona, and they're a trio of three women from LA. They have a new album out called Saves the World, and it's a mix of really beautiful, emotional, quite vulnerable, longing vocals and very funny and heartbreaking storytelling in their lyrics, and just a very powerful femininity that kind of moves through every song and throughout the whole album. The very brilliant writer and friend of the High Lows, Caroline O'Donoghue, tipped me off about them, and we went to go see them last night, and it was this like really gentle, magic, very millennial energy in the room. The lead singer at one point said, "I know that some people have tweeted me saying that they were worried about tonight's gig because they suffer from anxiety or like crowd-related anxiety."
Oh, that is millennial.
It was quite, I have to say, it made me very uncomfortable. And then it was actually really lovely because you're just not used to it in that setting. And she did this like group breathing that we all did at the same time. And then they played this like Pandora smirking.
Quite woo-woo.
Caroline and I were like, do you remember when rock stars used to throw like used tampons out to the audience and bite off the heads of bats? But it was actually really lovely. And they played this like big stompy dance track, and one of the other members of the bands was like, let's all enjoy dancing, but let's all also respect each other's personal space. So it's kind of like the opposite of Riot Girls, while still having this like really powerful, impeachable energy. They're not like, I'm making them sound very mimsy. They're not. They're very cool, and they have a very kind of strong, very nostalgic 90s aesthetic.
Yeah, they look quite All Saints. Dolly showed me a picture earlier. I know nothing about music, but I did enjoy their sounds.
I played this song to Panda that I'm going to insert now that I love so much, and it's the lead singer, who I think is in her 30s, talking to her younger self and kind of giving her advice from beyond, and it's just so lovely, and it's just beautiful melody, and it's kind of like the millennial version of the sunscreen song. You're gonna cut off your hair with dull scissors from the desk in your dorm room. Learn by trial and error. The threesomes are more sad than fun. You're gonna move to LA. Guess you're running away from the patterns you have and the decisions that you.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
For the High Low comes from Secret Spa.
Secret Spa brings beauty treatments to the home. Avoid the schlep to the salon and book London's best beauty and massage therapists straight to your home, hotel or workplace through Secret Spa's mobile app.
I have a confession to make.
Go on.
I used Secret Spa last night. Sunday night massage in the comfort of my own bedroom.
I thought you seemed a bit overly relaxed today. I'm deeply envious, snuffling through my revolting colds. You do look the epitome of health and relaxation.
Oh, thank you. It was so, so good. There was a lot of deep tissue elbow action.
Oh, yeah.
Unknotting my crunchy old back. It was so, so good. Secret Spa offers a full menu of at-home beauty and wellness treatments, including massage, manicures, waxing, spray tan, lashes and brows. There's no need to worry about travelling home after a relaxing massage or facial that's left you red-faced, or worry about smudging your toenails. Personally, I literally just rolled straight into bed yesterday afterwards.
And unlike a salon, you can book out-of-hours appointments from 7 in the morning to 10 in the evening, so you can squeeze your beauty treatments in before, during or after work around your busy day. As a mother to a toddler, I cannot describe how convenient this is. I virtually never go to a salon anymore. If I'm ever going to have a pedicure or treat myself to a massage, then I do it at 7:30 p.m. at home for the same price, if not frequently cheaper than actually going to a salon.
The quality of therapists is consistently excellent because Secret Spa puts such effort into finding the very best after rigorous rounds of assessment. I can attest that my massage therapist was utterly brilliant last night. Prices start at £35, and to enjoy an exclusive £15 off your first booking, download the Secret Spa app or visit secretspa.co.uk and use the code HILO at checkout.
Thank you very much to Secret Spa.
Our guest this week is Jen Brister. Jen is a critically acclaimed stand-up comedian, actor, and now author. She's presented for BBC Six Music, written and performed on BBC Radio 4's The News Quiz and The Now Show. She has performed 5 solo comedy shows around the world and has appeared on our screens on Comedy Central, Frankie Boyle's New World Order, and Live at the Apollo.
Do you know what I wish? One of my mates had taken me to one side and just given me an idea about what to expect. You know, just sat me down, gave me a little bit of a truth bomb. I would have appreciated this conversation, Brister. Hello, mate. Why don't you sit down? Just to let you know, it's a bit of a horror show. You're never going to finish a cup of tea or coffee again. You're going to have a shit with the door open. Your sex life is over. Your social life is dead. And if you want to have an ice cream, you're going to have it behind a bin in the garden. Anyway, congratulations.
Last week, her first book was published by Square Peg, an imprint of Penguin Random House, a memoir titled The Other Mother, in which she tells the hilarious, unflinchingly honest story of how she and her partner Chloe decided to have a baby, ended up with twin boys, and what it is like to raise them as a self-confessed middle-aged adolescent and as the other mother. Jen, welcome to the High Low.
This is a real treat.
We're glad.
It is, genuinely.
Jen, in your own words, would you like to tell us your story about starting a family and when you realised it was a story you wanted to tell and an experience you wanted to share?
As soon as Chloe got pregnant, I wanted to just find something, anything at all, that reflected who I was in this in our family. There was nothing. There was one book that you could order from the United States, which was really, really, again, very earnest. And I was like, it was more about how it made people feel emotionally about not being biologically connected to their children. And I was like, I don't care. It's not a problem. It's not an issue for me. So I sort of swerved that. And then I started to write sort of blogs for Standard Issue, which was Sarah Millican's website.
Yeah.
And then on the back of that, people seemed to really enjoy it. And a lot of people contacted me to say, I'm also another mother. This has been really great. The actual journey of IVF and going through it all, I suppose we felt a little bit, not isolated, but felt like outsiders in what was quite a universal experience, is wanting a family. And I felt like that was a bit of a shame, really, that we weren't included. And all of the books that we looked at were quite either very prescriptive or they were very heteronormative. And I felt, particularly as somebody not only that is not genetically connected to my children and not carrying them, that was like, well, what is the actual point of me? So the writing of the book, I felt it was quite cathartic, and I found it quite sort of like therapeutic to write it as well.
Kids lend themselves well to comedy. I always really enjoy when Ramesh Ranganathan talks about his kids, and Ali Wong's obviously done Baby Cobra. What were the preconceptions or myths that you wanted to shatter, not just about parenthood, but about same-sex parenthood? Was the experience different to what you had expected?
Yeah, so there's the lack of literature. That was a big thing, to at least contribute something for people like myself. I think Chloe, a lot of the time, carried quite a lot of guilt about stuff that I was like, I don't know what you're feeling guilty about. You haven't done anything wrong. And our children are happy, they're fed, they're healthy, they're thriving. I felt like most of the time we were doing great. I mean, it was horrific.
Because Chloe gave birth to your boys and breastfed.
She double breastfed them.
Yeah.
Yeah. What a legend.
Yeah, that is a double breastfeeding. Do you just have one under each, two footballs?
Yeah.
Could she walk with them?
No, there was no walking with them.
Because when you've got one, you can do the old walking feeding.
No.
But I wondered if that's fucking risky.
I mean, if I'd seen her do that, I'd been like, hats off to you. That seems unnecessary.
That sounds like a Britain's Got Talent.
Yeah.
Simon Cowell's face on that comes on.
We appreciate that you can breastfeed both your babies. We're not sure if the nation needs to see it.
So much about this book feels universal as a parenting experience, whatever the kind of reader's family might look like. But you do talk very clearly and often very movingly about the specifics of having a family in a partnership of two women. Something that struck me in the early chapters of the book is how much more as an LGBTQ plus couple you have to think about becoming a parent. There's this kind of strangely, I hadn't really thought about it before, there's this strangely privileged position as a heterosexual couple that when you're trying for a baby that you just make a decision or sometimes don't make a decision to have a kid and then you have sex and see what happens. Whereas there are so many more choices to make when you're in your position. Do you think you speak kind of early on in the book about how the prospect of parenthood was quite daunting and quite overwhelming? And do you think that that might have been because of all these kind of decisions that you had to make?
Yeah, that's a very good question, actually. I hadn't thought about it like that, but yeah, I think so. When you're having to spend not just months, but years thinking about it and stressing about it, and there's a lot of, you know, for any woman that's gone through IVF, it's a very kind of emotionally, I think, quite traumatic experience, or it can be. And, you know, some women deal with it really well, like Chloe, as I talk about in my book, is a robot. But
she got more stressed out about what the Netflix choice is.
Yeah, I mean, like, literally, she didn't seem to, I mean, there were so many hormones that she took and they didn't, didn't seem to affect her at all. But I think because there was such a lot to consider, I suppose that did make the whole idea of being a parent feel more, feel more daunting, I suppose. And I don't think I'd really thought about it before, but you spend a lot longer working your way up to the point of the pregnancy. I mean, the 9 months of being pregnant, I don't know how you found it, Pandora, but I certainly, watching Chloe being pregnant for 9 months, it felt like it went on for years.
48 years, yeah.
Yeah, just, I was like, when is this baby coming out? And so we had so much lead up. So by the time the children were born, it was like, I think, what's happening? Why? You know, it was overwhelming. But equally, you know as a couple that you, without a shadow of a doubt, you want those children. There is no, shall we keep it? Shall we, obviously you want it.
Were you always sure about what roles you would both play?
100%. Yeah. I mean, I do talk about this in my stand-up, but there was, people did ask me all the time. They were like, how did you know you didn't want to be the biological mum? And it's because I'm not fucking stupid, of course. And why would I do it when I get her to do it? It doesn't make any sense.
Do you manage to, something I read about recently is obviously we're all quite au fait with the slightly beleaguered term emotional labour, which has kind of been a bit bastardised from what it was meant to be in the 80s. But I learned about something new recently called the allostatic load, which is about like those really small, so even if you have share your childcare 50-50 like me and my husband do, the allostatic load is like these tiny things that often in a relationship, if it's a man and a woman, keep the woman's cortisol elevated like all night long. When the man gets back from work, his cortisol goes down and hers stay up because she's thinking about stuff like, do I need to buy new shoes for the child or for my child, or where are her hair ties kept? So a really common one that I read about, which made me laugh, was this woman being like, if I asked my husband, he would know that she wore hair ties and hair bows, but he wouldn't ever put them in himself and he wouldn't know where they're kept. And I was like, that is exactly actually what's in my relationship, is it's the allostatic load. Do you have the 50-50 breakdown of the allostatic load as well? I mean,
no.
Your boys probably don't wear that many hair bows. They might do, but would you know where the equivalent of their hair bows was?
So I'm just trying to think what the equivalent
would be. Or vice versa, would Chloe know where the equivalent of hair bows would be?
Oh no, Chloe knows where everything is. She knows, she's the organised one.
I wonder if there's ever a full breakdown of the minutiae, whatever the configuration of you as parents.
Do you know what? I confess that Chloe is probably the person that anticipates those sorts of things and way ahead of. I might think about it, but she'll be like, yeah, I already did that like 3 months ago because that's when it needed to happen. So I would say that Chloe is definitely on top of all of that. And in many ways, she has a better handle of that, I think. And also because I know that she's doing it, I suppose there's a little bit of me that goes, well, Chloe's got that. Mm. But I do try to make sure that I am sort of, I have like a general, I'm trying to really backpedal here. generally, as a sort of like overseeing what's happening across what our children are, I think I have
across genre expertise.
Yeah, I think so. But I would say that she's definitely better at it. I've never been good at that sort of stuff, even for myself.
It's interesting that when you, how you're saying that in your NCT classes, maybe as a same-sex couple, you're more aware watching heterosexual couples, those kind of default traditional roles. Like I found it interesting in the book when you said that there was a couple before you and Chloe had children, you remember meeting a couple with a newborn daughter at a wedding. And the bloke was like, yeah, nothing's changed.
This is my favourite. One of my best friends who's got two kids was sitting next to a guy like this the other day. And she was like, he was literally telling me, he has a newborn baby. And he was like telling her how easy it was and how nothing's changed. She was like, I can guarantee he's literally doing nothing.
Totally. And he was like, it's a state of mind.
It's absolutely true. And he was like, I went to a festival on... He was like, I went out to a festival in September and blah, blah, blah. And I was like, but what about, you know, your wife and the baby? And then, oh, they're staying at home, but I'm going. And I was like, well, then what? Hang on a second. Yeah. It was only afterwards I really thought about it. And I thought, you absolute bellend, you're doing nothing.
Yeah.
And if your life hasn't changed because you're still going away abroad for work, you know, and you'll have drinks and you'll go out to nice restaurants and you'll come back late and you can't get up for the baby because you've got to get up early in the morning. And there's all of that. So, yeah, your life hasn't changed. But I'll give her another year before she tries to, like, smother you in your sleep, you know. I don't know if it's maybe because... As a woman, this is a bit massive generalisation. It's probably not very true, actually. But I think you anticipate more for each other. I feel like I don't really feel like Chloe's ever had to ask me to do stuff. I think most of the time I can see that Chloe needs this, so I will anticipate it. And what I've discovered, it's not that my friends' husbands or boyfriends are terrible partners. They just don't think about it.
Yeah.
They don't anticipate it. And I think my friends just get annoyed about having to keep reminding them to... Could you just once just... do this without me having to tell you, because that's when that idea of being the nagging and it's not, it's like if I don't ask you to do it, then I do it and that you still don't do it, so
try to even out the load.
And I feel like I've seen so many straight women in those relationships who are like the least naggy, uptight humans that have been, against their will, kind of forced into this role where they are this naggy person.
Yeah, and I just find it and also the whole term nagging gets on my tits as well. It's like, if you're not listening to me and I can constantly having to communicate the same thing, that's not nagging. That's you being a twat and not listening. You know, there's certain language that is used around as soon as you have children that is used for women that I find, that really grates.
The book details the very unique experience of what it is to be the other mother, by which you mean, as we've said, the mother of two children who you didn't give birth to. You talk about the kind of bewilderment and discomfort and rudeness that you sometimes had to face from strangers who were, for some reason, kind of confused by your family. There's one bit where you talk about a woman in the park saying to you that she's sure she's seen your kids before, and it must have been with their dad. And you respond, yeah, you might have seen him. He's 5'2", blonde, and a woman. I also really appreciated your description that I found really enlightening of how these sorts of constant justifications can make you feel like you're kind of coming out again on a daily basis.
Yeah.
And how kind of tiring that can be. Were you surprised by how people have responded to your family setup, or was it something that you were prepared for?
I think I was prepared for it, but as my children have got older, those questions, you don't get as much of those questions. But when they are babies, people are fascinated with babies and like to coo over them, and they like to ask questions. And when you have twins, you become almost like a circus sideshow. People are...
Two girls, two boys.
Yeah, they're like, you know, let's talk, you know, hormonally, we've nailed it. But they just want to... I mean, we just used to get stopped. We would literally get stopped walking down the street. People would go, oh, are they twins? I'm a twin. I've got a twin. I know twins. I used to be twins. I've seen twins. I love the film Twins. You're like, who are you? Go away.
I love the film Twins.
You know, and then those questions would come out, and it was always excruciating. And I would find it almost more excruciating when I was with Chloe, because they would go, so who's mum? And then we'd go, oh, and then a lot of the time I'd go, Yeah, she's mum. Oh, twins, how did you cope? Oh my God, you and your partner must be so happy. And then Chloe go, no, she's my partner. And I go, yeah, me, I'm the partner. And they're like, oh, right. Oh, good for you. Good. And then you have to go through that whole thing. That, how did you do that? It's like, who are you? I would never dream of coming up to a straight couple and going, it's twins. Oh my God, how did you do that? What was your position? I mean, tell me everything. You know, how were they conceived? You get to a point where you do get a sort of, I suppose, you just lose patience with it. I had a lot more patience at the beginning, and then it gradually sort of, like, you get to the point where you just want to go, two fingers, go away. Mm.
You lay bare a lot of the insanity of parenthood, which made me laugh because it is just so universal. As you say, whatever you're set up as a family, there are some things that are just completely ubiquitous, and one of which is struggling with the tiredness, which you just can't really predict until you have children. And you say you became a Zen master of insane sleeplessness, and you write in detail as well about the evolution of their poo, which is Dolly's favourite subject, by the way.
Oh yeah, I'm so sorry. That really upsets some people, so
I'm not good with poo, Jen.
I really enjoyed it.
Pandora's great with poo, so you two, you know.
Yeah.
So the poo segued from a mild-mannered continual thing into something that reeks so badly that it seeps into the walls. Have you always found humour in the scatological?
I do think his poo's quite funny. But I appreciate it's not for everyone. I remember when I was...
It's not for everyone, it's from everyone.
It's definitely from everyone, but definitely not for everyone. I think poo's funny, and I think I'm learning that not everyone does. I used to do material about... I did a poo story on stage and I had to ditch it because people were either laughing or groaning, and I'm like, I can't have groaning. I cannot have groaning. I think sometimes poo stories are better written down as well. But
yeah, I think really they're great written down. You're right, actually. There's definitely a power in the written poo story.
Yeah, I think poo squared.
A part of the book that I really enjoyed reading was your honesty on how life changes after you have children, and how you have to accept that you're, when you have kids, you're in a different life and that you are a different version of yourself. And I really appreciated your honesty on that, and I think that's such a generous thing to give, because of what we were saying about how dogmatic parenting can be. It feels like it's rare that parents can admit so candidly about all the things they've lost or the things that they miss, because somehow that might negate their kind of love of parenting, which obviously it doesn't. But you talk about how your life now, first and foremost, doesn't centre around you. And it's one where hangover with two children means a night of drinking comes with a fun tax. How have you found that shift as the kids have gotten older? Is it something you've accepted, or do you still kind of mourn your old life?
I don't mourn my old life at all. I accept all of the sacrifices that come with being a parent. I let's not forget, I was 39 when they were born, so if I haven't got that out of my system. Also, as you get, you know, once you hit your 40s, your energy levels diminish quite dramatically. But there are times when you would, like, you know, you can't be impulsive in the way that you used to. You can't say, I've always wanted, let's go to Madrid for the weekend, that sort of stuff. Mm. We did take the children to Madrid. Why did we do that? And we spent the whole time we were there going, wouldn't it be lovely if we were here without the kids? You know, so there's stuff like that, of course. You know, there are obviously things that you're going to miss when you have children, but the things that I've gotten from having them far outweigh anything that I missed from before. Mm. And so I'm quite content with where I am. And also with my job, I suppose, as a stand-up comedian, I do get to go away enough that if I want to have that occasional blowout, I can still sort of, you know, have that. Chloe doesn't get to have it quite as much as I do.
I was so determined for motherhood not to change my own... to change my identity, and it's such a fallacy. I was, like, chasing the impossible, and eventually it ate me. I'm much more comfortable in that role, although I've still got far to go. Do you think that you have completely reconciled your identities now? Do you think mothers or women ever do?
I don't know that you have to, and I think it's okay for there to be, for you to feel conflicted sometimes, and for you to feel like, oh, this isn't exactly what I wanted. Or you know, you
all
are going to
fragmented.
Yeah, there's, it will be fragmented, and I think we're told that, well, you made your choice, you've got to be happy about it all the time. I challenge anyone to have made any decision that they're 100%, you know, completely delighted with every second of the day. You know, even if it's a job you love, there are points where I'm sure, you know. I'm sure before you, for example, Dolly, wrote your book, you'd be like, if I could write a bestseller, that would be me happy for the rest of my life. And then you write a bestseller and you're like, well,
there's a name
what about the next bloody book?
You arrival know? Fallacy. Yeah. We talked about that.
Yeah, there
this
is...
This idea that, like, you'll have this one thing and then your life will just be golden.
But also, I think what I have realised very acutely in the last year is that with the acquisition of every new thing in your life...
You want something else?
No, beyond that, there are... It comes with like 50 things to worry about.
Yeah, I definitely feel like as I get to a point with my career that my profile has gone up, not sort of dramatically, but significantly enough that I've noticed it.
I've seen the bodyguards in the corner.
Yeah, don't shut up, you two. then it's definitely feels like it's created a bit more anxiety, which I don't think I had before, and I don't know what that anxiety is about or why
it's annoying as well.
You know, it's just, it's a weird thing that I feel I have, like 3 a.m. wake ups about, what did I say that to that person on the interview, or do you know what I mean? Like, whereas before I'd be like, well, no one's listening, no one cares, it doesn't matter.
Yeah,
you know. And now you feel like you're under a you're being examined in a way that you weren't. And so when you get any kind of success, you feel like you're being examined even closer and closer. And that can mean that you don't enjoy the success that you have, which is a shame, really, because you deserve to enjoy it. Mm. But I think the great thing about my children is that I'm not one of these... I'm terrible, really. I could really benefit from reading a self-help book. But I don't... I sort of... Anything that might be positive for me, my mental health, I tend to, like, ignore it. And I think my children have been really good at grounding me and demanding of my time in that moment and making me live in the moment so that I'm not just this kind of self-involved narcissist that I think I was becoming, or that I probably was. And I've really enjoyed that. I found it really freeing. Because I'm not just a mum, and I'm not just a stand-up comedian, and I'm not just a, you know, partner. There's lots of sides to me, and are you pregnant?
Yeah.
Sorry, I just noticed something. And then as I said it, went, don't say that, just in case.
That is a risky old exclamation.
Yeah.
And it's not that risky now.
I was like, you've got a small enough frame for me to be able to say that. Oh, congrats. That's brilliant.
Thank you. That sounded a bit like a twist on the Britney Spears song, I'm Not a Girl, Not Yet a Woman. Not the pregnant bit.
Oh, right. Okay. I'm not getting that.
No, exactly about that. You were funny as well about, there was like a delicious irony in the way that motherhood changed your work as well. You said sort of, ironically, as you got more exhausted and gave less of a shit because you just had to get in there and get out, you started to see this real progression in your career.
Yeah.
Was that gratifying or mystifying?
It was mystifying because I was so tired. And
maybe that's a good lesson for us all.
Yeah, just turn up
out of sorts and nail it.
Yeah, get to the point where you feel like you're dead and then try and do your job.
I think it actually is a good... Because when I read that section of the book, I did feel like that is a good lesson to us. Because basically... What it's saying is, it's like that Diana Athill quote that we read on the high-low when she died, where she said, I've never been ashamed of the fact that life outside of my office has always been more important to me than the work I did in the office, which is quite a simple sentiment, but something that you don't hear that much as an admission. And what really I got from you saying, from you describing that period of your life, was when my home life and my relationship to my family and my partner became the most all-encompassing important thing, I stopped being so anxious and obsessing over the work, and therefore the work was just this way I paid my bills, but also this thing that I did in the evening, and then suddenly it just got so much better.
Yeah, I
I think there's a danger when you are dissatisfied with where your career is going, that you obsess about it, you become almost sort of irrational about how you can move your career forward, and you kind of strangle every opportunity because it becomes, if I don't nail this, then it's like an all or nothing. Every opportunity is, when in, the reality is it's never all or nothing. And if you go in and you're just like I was, just almost defeated by the day, and I just wanted to get through, then I stopped offering. I think I stopped doing, because with stand-up comedy, if you turn up as a comedian and you're like, you're saying, please like me.
Yeah, desperate to please.
The audience, even if you look really confident, if that's...
Smell your fit.
They can smell it. They'll smell it off you and they're like, oh, she seems a bit desperate. But if it's, once I got to the point where the children were like, you know,
you're wanting them to like you.
Yeah, I was more worried about them liking me. Yeah, that was, they were my hardest audience. But if you go in as a performer and you're not asking, you're just saying, this is it, this take this, this is what I'm doing. Audiences love that. Mm. They love it. They're like, oh god, she's like, she's a maverick, you know. And so that really works. And then also, I don't know if this is just because of, as a comedian, I've just been going for such a long time and it's just a natural progression or what. But also, I do feel like now the subject matter that I talk about on stage is way closer to the stuff I've wanted to do, and I haven't been able to make it funny, or I don't feel like I had the tools or the skill to do it. And now I really feel like I can. And so I feel much more fulfilled in my work, being able to you know, make funny the stuff that I actually care about rather than just, you know, doing impressions of my mum, which are hilarious. But
I love those.
We're boring.
Me. You did one earlier and it's very good. Jen, thank you so much for joining us on The High Low. The Other Mother is out now and we urge you to read it. It's a very funny, often tender account of parenting and family life.
Thank you so much. I've had a ball.
Thanks, Jen.
Thank you very much for listening to The High Low. You can rate, review and subscribe on iTunes. It helps other people find us and helps boost us in the charts. You can email us, thehighlowshow@gmail.com, or tweet us at @thehighlowshow. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.